That sounds really good. So good morning, everybody, and welcome to the House of the Rising Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And so, yes, we are going to go on to the next FAQ from FACIM. Or let's see.
Yeah.
That works.
They're all so good. I mean,
yeah.
I don't think there's a bad one in the bunch.
So let me get, wait a minute. Now I have.
You want me to send it, put the link?
Yeah, send me the link again. I had it from last week, but it's not showing up on my Skype.
Let me paste it in the chat window. There you go.
Okay. Gracias.
Certainly.
It's lots easier when you have a link. And
yeah, exactly.
And I'll put the link in the room, too, so anybody else can go and look as well.
And actually, these are fairly short, so we can maybe do a couple of them, because the next one is also good, too.
Very good, yeah. And you know what? Since last week, I went back and got a now you can get that book, Stranger in a Strange Land, online in a PDF. And what's interesting is, this is really fascinating, Bruce. Robert Heinlein, when he wrote that book, and this was back in the 60s, and I don't know if you, I'm sure you did read that book, and most of us.
Long time ago.
Yeah, okay. So it had some pretty revolutionary thoughts in it. Mm-hmm. And really did a number on me, believe me. When I read that stuff and I realized, oh my gosh, all these things I thought were true about the morals and the you know, I mean, obviously I didn't think these things were true because I was already questioning the reality of everything that man made up as far as government and religion and everything. By the time I was like 12, I was ready to just leave society completely. But because I realized it was all a bunch of made up crap that it had no basis whatsoever in truth. So then when I, and you know where I got a lot of this from? From, first off, because I went to Catholic school and I realized that, the church didn't really know anything about God. And then, it was real obvious to me that they were oblivious to his true nature. And, but then the other thing was that when I was, 12, in, social, they put me in public school the first time ever, to go to public school. And, we had social studies and I heard about this lady named Margaret Mead, who was a cultural anthropologist and, who had gone to some of these, places where native people had not been exposed to modern society. And she studied these cultures and she noticed in these cultures the lack of, shame about sexuality and the body, and you know, nudity was normal. A lot of the hang-ups that you know we have because of our church and culture and everything, these people just didn't have. And so when I'm 12 years old, I'm reading this stuff and I'm realizing, oh my gosh, the world is not what I thought it was, and people are not the way I thought they were, and, you know, God is not what I thought he was, and, you know, all that stuff. And then when I was, I think I was 16, maybe 17, 16, I got this book, Stranger in a Strange Land, and it was about a man who came from a culture that was completely non-human, and so the author was able to just, you know, really imagine what it would be like not to have been raised with our culture. Mm-hmm. And the point that I'm getting to here is that when Robert Heinlein wrote the book and tried to publish it back in the 60s, the publishers were just aghast at some of the things that he included. And so, which were things like free love, there was lots of, very free and open sexuality in the book. And also, one thing that they did, which Martians did, was when one of them would discorporate or die, the community would eat the body because they had very few resources on Mars. And so that was part of the culture he came from, was that you ate the dead. And so that was something that just shocked the heck out of people. And it was still included in the book, but not as graphically. But the publishers made him take out a lot of stuff that was very even more controversial than the stuff that is in the book was in the original printing. And so now there's a whole new version that after he passed away and the copyright ended, his family found the original version. And
the Urtext.
Yeah, the Urtext of A Stranger in a Strange Land, exactly. And so it's like almost a third longer of a book. So I've started reading it, and I'm interested to hear, you know, what this guy who, you know, completely turned our culture upside down in the 60s. And a lot of young people read that book and became, like I was, mesmerized by it. I was mesmerized by the idea of brotherhood and that you could just share everything with everyone and it was not going to be a problem. And, you know, it was good stuff. Anyway, so I don't know why I felt compelled to tell you about that.
Well, that is interesting because I think actually it ties into the following question in the FAQ about brotherhood. But there's so many things that you just touched on there that are interesting because, you know, the whole idea that, you know, we don't understand what the world is for, and those early workbook lessons really address that very nicely, is that, you know, we have so many preconceptions, misconceptions, misinterpretations just out of the chute with you know, having adopted so thoroughly the mind set and the teacher, if you will, of the ego. And we, you know, at such an early age that we don't even, you know, well, beyond an early age, we came here with a fully intact ego, as Ken points out in some of his work. That, you know, it's not like you have to, essentially we adopt and developed the persona that happens with the ego, but in terms of the thought system, you know, we pick up right where we left off in whatever we believe about or not, don't believe about reincarnation. But, you know, just, you know, it's not like we get this instant promotion or demotion when we are, you know, choose to believe that we're in a body.
Right.
So for all intents and purposes, you know, there's really no, you know, no change necessarily when we are born into a body or believe that we are, because that it's not about the body. It's not about the form. So, you know, and then, you know, another thing that you touched on there with, you know, the cannibalism is we're so horrified and aghast about that. And, you know, rightly so, I think, in terms of on the level of the mind, that we would want to devour and cannibalize something. But yet we do that with viruses and bacteria and plants and animals without even batting an eye, you know, and yet. You know, the course doesn't suggest that we stop eating or breathing or drinking water, but at the same time, to be cognizant of the insanity of the thought system that made the world and forgive it. That's I think where the release comes from, and that's what I think the first FAQ addresses that really nicely.
Well, good. Well, yeah. Why don't you go ahead and start reading the question then of 1163.
Okay, so FAQ number 1163 starts out, in the first chapter of A Course in Miracles, Jesus talks about a traumatic experience that could result from starting on the later stages of the Course without the preparation that careful study of the earlier sections would provide, because awe would then be likely confused with fear. And that's from the first chapter of the text, section 7, and paragraphs 4 and 5. How exactly can your study of the Course result in a traumatic experience? Which, more precisely, are the early sections and which the later ones that Jesus is referring to in the text? Do you want to read the first paragraph of the answer?
Actually, I would like to go and look at this chapter, this paragraph in the text.
Okay.
Let's do that. I'm like, where...
Yeah, I think the question is a little bit, you know, exaggerated or taken out of context. It seems like a little bit from what I recall, but yeah, let's do that.
Okay, so it's in text 1, section 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Distortion of miracle.
I'm going to go to my treeware, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's another classic one, isn't it?
And then the, let me go back here and find the, let's see. So it's paragraphs 4 and 5. Okay, so let me see, what does that say? This is a course in mind training. All learning involves attention and study at some level. Some of the later parts of the course rest too heavily on these earlier sections not to require their careful study. I see that what they're saying is that, okay, you will also need them for preparation. Without this, you may become much too fearful of what is to come to make constructive use of it. However, as you study these earlier sections, you will begin to see some of the implications that will be amplified later on. A solid foundation is necessary because of the confusion between fear and awe, to which I have already referred and which is often made. I have said that awe is inappropriate in connection with the sons of God because you should not experience awe in the presence of your equals. However, it was also emphasized that awe is proper in the presence of your Creator. I have been careful to clarify my role in the atonement without either over or understating it. I am also trying to do the same with yours. I have stressed that an awe is not appropriate reaction to me because of our inherent equality. Some of the later steps in this course, however, involve a more direct approach to God Himself. It would be unwise to start on these steps without careful preparation, or awe will be confused with fear, and the experience will be more traumatic than beatific. Healing is of God in the end. The means are being carefully explained to you. Revelation may occasionally reveal the end to you, but to reach it, the means are needed. So, yeah, this is really, you know, I didn't never think about it this way, but he really is saying that, you know, as much as you might think that you get these things, and a lot of people do, just do the lessons. You know, there's a lot of people who say, I did A Course in Miracles, and what they did was they did the lessons, but they didn't read the text, they didn't read the manual for teachers, or the psychotherapy pamphlet, or the Song of Prayer, or any of the other stuff, and they think they know what the course is about. Mm-hmm. But Jesus is right, especially if you don't understand the miracle principles, which I'm not sure how many people actually do. In fact, I'm not sure I even do. So, because they are serious.
Yeah, certainly the self that we typically identify with most of the time doesn't. That's why we need the course, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, the very first miracle principle, excuse me, that there is no order of difficulty in miracles, that in itself is the entire course. Just that. Mm-hmm. There's no order of difficulty in miracles. And if you understood that, you would have everything. And, you know, so I understand why they're saying that. It makes sense that, you know, well, I don't think Jesus is warning people. I think he's just saying that, you know, he's talking about a traumatic experience. I don't really see that it's so much that they're talking about a traumatic experience. I just think they're talking about you just are not going to get it, and it might scare you. Because you don't understand the concept that's being presented to you.
Yeah, and it's a developmental curriculum. I think that's a point that's overlooked by, you know, a few months ago, some friends of the family stopped by and chatting on the driveway. You know, the conversation about the course came up because I mentioned I was, you know, working with that and a website involving it. And they said, oh, yeah, we did the course years ago. We spent a year and did the course. And you know, that's exactly what you said. And yet, you know, the obviously anything more than a casual encounter with it reveals the fact that this is a very profound curriculum. I mean, and not to say that it's different. Ironically, because, you know, from other paths, because ultimately all paths, you know, inexorably lead to the same realization and the same revelation. But the groundwork that's necessary to get there, you know, this happens to be a particularly effective, you know, kind of, it's sort of the bullet train or the SR-71, depending on which you want to metaphor, of spiritual paths in the sense that, you know, the step-by-step developmental approach is really laid out for us in such with such clarity and with such heart and genuineness and with, you know, not only tremendous depth in terms of the feeling behind it, but also with tremendous clarity and truly divine logic, I think, you know, the wisdom behind it is just so amazing. And not to say that other paths and other teachings don't have tremendous amounts of that, but I think that the fact that, you know, you and I are talking about this and whoever's listening has probably been drawn to it. It's like, well, if it's working for us, why not do what it suggests and see if it works, you know? And we have examples of those that it has worked for, you know?
Exactly. And believe me, if you ever listen to, Carolyn Chang, she's here on Monday mornings or Mondays, and she is not a Course in Miracles student. She's a lady who, has been through a profound spiritual transformation. So her profound spiritual transformation came about when she was watching the movie What the Bleep. And one of the people, Lynn McTaggart, said something about we're all one or something of that nature. And it just Carolyn was watching the movie and she just came to a sudden realization of the oneness. And she became immersed in the oneness, and it was like a revelatory experience for her. And so she and her son had I don't know if her son had just died. She had just gone through some really traumatic stuff. And so she decided to start doing a radio show called Awake to Oneness, and she started interviewing people. I mean, she's interviewed Marianne Williamson and Michael Beckwith and all kinds of people. And then she just calls them up and says, can I interview you? And they say yes. And so she's got all these people. But she had never heard of A Course in Miracles until she started interviewing these people. And the more of these people that she interviewed that were awake, really profoundly awakened people, were students of A Course in Miracles. So that's how she learned about it, was from talking to these people who, you know, obviously had this experience. And so I'm finding more and more and more people who have had profound awakening experiences from A Course in Miracles from someone who isn't even a course teacher or student, but who fell upon it through inquiry. So the reason I'm saying that is because people don't understand that the purpose of the course, even though it's not formally what the world would call awakening, it's exactly what Jesus is talking about. He says, you've got to do like I did. You've got to be like me. You are exactly like me, and you can be exactly like me and experience your world exactly the way I did. And you will see that there's nothing, you know, there's no fear, there's no death, there's, you know, all these things that I was able to show in the world during my incarnation, you know, if you believe that, you can do that also. And, you know, that's what we were just reading from the course, from chapter 1, section 7, paragraphs, what, 6 and 7 or whatever they were.
4 or 5, the last two paragraphs in chapter 1, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So that's the purpose. That's the reason that doing these things is so important. So I think this is what this FAQ is going to say, and I'm going to read. Jesus does not identify specifically which sections in the text are the early ones and which are the later ones, but he is basically talking, and think about this, this is chapter 1. He's talking in chapter 1, so the other sections of the text haven't even been written yet. So so he's talking about something that doesn't even exist at this moment. Anyway, he says, but he is basically talking about not jumping from the bottom of the spiritual ladder right up to the top without taking the intervening steps. Many people want instant enlightenment and do not want to do the often unpleasant and uncomfortable work of looking at their egos and how their lives have been directed by their choice to have the ego as their teacher instead of the Holy Spirit. That's not a pretty sight in our minds. We will never be able to truly get beyond the ego and all its hate and selfishness without looking at it and humbly admitting we were wrong in wanting the special identity the ego offered in place of our true identity as Christ. We must learn how to do that, trusting Jesus' word more and more that we will not be punished, even annihilated as the ego warns us, for having made a substitute for God's love, for having made a substitute for God's love. We must practice every day how to shift the purpose of our lives and our relationships from the egos to the Holy Spirit's. But we cannot do that without seeing, sometimes shockingly so, the extent of our investment in the ego and how we manifest the ego's madness of separation 24 hours a day, usually. Usually is right. And this is it. You know, where does Jesus say to us, you know, why do you ask how the tiny man idea could have come about? You're doing it now. You do it every moment. That we're constantly turning away from the truth and choosing specialness. You know, that's a continual activity in the life of the human. And so Jesus is asking us, you know, just take a look at this. And here I'm going to show you, first off, why specialness is not helpful. And I'm going to show you how to get out of that thought system and to remember your true mind and you remember God. So, you know, instead of being a big shock to us, I think really what happens is that we're gently, very, very gently eased into this, or for me it has been anyway, this knowing of the truth about myself and the truth about God. Beautiful, beautiful question and answer here, Bruce. Thank you for picking this out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, it's just the next one that we, from continuing from last week.
It works.
Since I've been a bit busy. Yeah. And to tie into what you were saying a little earlier before you read the first paragraph, I think it's important to remember to live our lives exactly like Jesus did obviously has nothing to do with the level of form, but everything to do with the level of mind, because if this is a curriculum in mind training and not about anything to do with space or time or bodies or personas, or certainly the thought system of the sin, guilt, fear, death, you know, tyranny of ego specialness, then, you know, what we're being gently and very, very gently encouraged to do is to just look at the contents of our mind with that inner kindness teacher and see, as this paragraph you just read points out, how insane. It's not, and I love how Ken Wapnick, you know, reinforces in so many different programs that he has done, both, you know, written and audio and video and otherwise, that, you know, it's not evil or sinful or wicked, because those are all labels the ego would like to, you know, plaster all over us. But it's just silly. And that's where the identity shift happens gradually. And I think we have this gradual experience of shifting our identity from what doesn't work, and to what does, and to see that over and over again in a very gentle way, but sometimes it can seem jarring to the extent that we're identified with the ego, that it really is, you know, as it says, sometimes shockingly so, that, you know, our approach hasn't worked and it will continue to not work because it is doomed. It's foolproof. It's a horrifically insane, insidious plot to have us identify with a dualistic thought system that just intrinsically can never work. But as the Course points out so eloquently and comfortingly, it may be foolproof, but it's not God-proof. And the fact that we are, each one of us as one being, seemingly as separate selves, that one offspring of God, if you will, only because that's a placeholder concept that we can relate to. And we gradually can go through the developmental process of seeing that there is this, and we each have our own sequence, and the form is different, but the content is the same. Is gradually letting go of our investment in the ego, and seeing that what we tried to do on our own with that sort of John Wayne ethic, I'll do it myself, isn't working. You know, it's just never going to work. Should I read the next paragraph?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. The point is, we have covered all of that over because we were convinced that unspeakably horrific things would happen if we ever remembered we have a mind, and then would go back there and look at what we chose. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
There is such fear buried there that if we were to approach God directly, we would surely be thrown into a disabling panic. We need to approach God indirectly through forgiveness and a relationship with Jesus or the Holy Spirit first, because all of the distorted notions we have implanted in our minds about who God is and what we can expect of Him when we meet Him face to face. So we're basically undoing a whole lot of chaff. In other words, if we want to, you know, get through that narrow gate, as it talks about in the Bible, we need to lose a bunch of the garbage that we're hanging on to, and we're not going to take the baggage of the whole sin, guilt, fear paradigm with us. And if we're not at peace, how can we expect to have a revelation that brings us face to face with the peace that can never change? So we need to gradually ease into a letting go. We gradually let go of our addiction to victimhood and masochism and pain, and those are all in the mind. And we do that by just taking the hand metaphorically of our inner kindness teacher, the Jesus or the Holy Spirit of the Course, and seeing that what we chose on our own just flat doesn't work. I mean, like Ken says, the maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem.
Well, and what I was thinking as you were reading this, the talk about approaching God directly, mm-hmm. and that would throw us into a disabling panic, and I realized that actually it's not that difficult to understand that. It seems like, you know, that, oh, God, you know, I love God and I would like to be close to God, and so I don't know why I would be panicking about it. But think about your approach to your brother. Think about times when you have an opportunity to have a conversation with another person. Maybe that conversation is a little uncomfortable because, you know, you feel a barrier between yourself and that other person. That could be anyone. Could be your husband, your wife, your child, your neighbor, your boss. How many people do we avoid having contact and conversation with because we are afraid and uncomfortable about what we perceive the outcome to be? Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is this belief in guilt that somehow or the other I have not lived up to our relationship goals or you know what I think I should be doing I'm not doing, or I have a feeling about it's all about guilt. All right, and so think about how many people who I hesitate to talk to because I have this even tiniest feeling of guilt. You know, if I owe the power company and I haven't paid the bill and it's late and I'm going to be cut off, you know, I call them up and I'm afraid to approach them because I'm feeling guilty because I didn't pay, because I'm bad, because I'm worthless, or whatever. And this is just a person on the phone who is, their job is to help you with your electrical bill. But if I'm afraid to call them, and, you know, I don't know if you relate to this or anybody relates to this, but think about somebody who you owe something to and how anxious you are to come in contact with them, how anxious you are to be, to talk to them about the situation. It's not the way the ego likes to deal with things. And so if I can't even talk to my brother openly and lovingly, because I'm worried and afraid of what transgressions I've done against them by not paying my bill or by, you know, whatever it is that I feel guilty about. And I don't think that there's a single relationship that we have in the world that isn't involved with guilt. There's mm-hmm. guilt behind all of it.
Right.
So, and again, here I'm on my bandwagon about guilt, but it's so important to see. Anyway, what I'm saying though is that if I'm afraid to approach my brother because of this guilt that is so on the surface, then think about why it is that I'm afraid to approach God. And why I don't approach God openly and lovingly, as the thing is as saying, there's such fear buried there that if we were to approach God directly, we would surely be thrown into a disabling panic. If you don't understand that, just think about your relationships with other people, even your husband or your wife.
Oh, sure.
You know, I want to go talk to my husband about a lot of stuff because I have guilt feelings in my, you know, I burnt the toast or.
But those are symbols for the deeper unconscious guilt. Exactly. And what you point out is really brilliant, Lynn, because we have to use the steps, as this FAQ reminds us, to undo the ego in a way that's comfortable for each of us, and only each of us, you know, knows what that's going to be. So we can't really define it for anybody else. But like you say, you know, just those everyday things, the relationships to the seeming others in our lives, whether it's around money or exchange or sex or you know, affection or bodily concerns and issues or food, or just there's so many, the whole gamut of the spectrum of things that are issues and topics that come up in our minds around just relating to and surviving in a world that we made to be problematic by default, gives us an incredibly rich classroom. It's mathematically perfect. I like to think of it as giving us exactly what we need to look at. And as you were saying it, you know, as you were just giving your example, I was thinking of, you know, a handful of things with each sentence you stated, of things that, you know, have been current things on my radar, you know, of the mind, of just things I'm looking at. And so that's, I appreciate you, you know, bringing it back to the pragmatic of just looking at all the things that come up in front of our face. As Gary Renard's teachers say, on any given day, that's our forgiveness classroom. That's where the rubber meets the road, and where we need to look at our minds and gently so, and be kind with ourselves when we, you know, fall back into that ego turf, and just say, and just laugh gently when we catch that and say, oh, there I went again. I guess I wasn't ready to experience that depth of love or peace. Huh?
Exactly. Yeah. But don't be afraid of, and that's all Jesus is saying. Don't be afraid to look, mm-hmm. because when you look, you'll see that it's nothing.
Right.
And so I think he's going to say that in the rest of the paragraph. So why don't you go ahead and finish reading that paragraph?
Okay. Let's see. So I think I left off with, let me just read the previous sentence here. We need to approach God indirectly through forgiveness and a relationship with Jesus or the Holy Spirit first, because of all the distorted notions we have implanted in our minds about who God is and what we can expect of him when we meet him face to face. Hence the need to do all the groundwork, which is basically our relationships here in the world to everything and everyone. Jesus discusses this indirect approach in chapter 14 of the text in the section called, quote, the conditions of learning, unquote. This is from chapter 14, section 1 in the text. Earlier in chapter 12, he tells us, you cannot lay aside the obstacles to real vision without looking upon them. For to lay aside means to judge against. If you will look, the Holy Spirit will judge, and he will judge truly. Yet he cannot shine away what you keep hidden, for you have not offered it to him, and he cannot take it from you. Another, you know, reminder of just what you're saying, Lynn, is we have to look at all the specifics in our forgiveness classroom, moment to moment, and just keep bringing them to mind, bringing them back to the forefront of our mind, where we can gently, without making big deals out of any of them, but just look at them kind of like My friend Leonard Lasko, who does workshops on forgiveness, I used to live in Southern Oregon when he did as well, and he would do workshops on forgiveness, even though he wasn't, of course, again, like you mentioned, so other people who have independently arrived at similar understanding. But one of the meditations he used was, I think he called it a Tibetan log meditation, where you just basically take all your thoughts that arise and imagine them placing them on a little log that's floating down the stream in front of you in your mind, and just watching them without trying to, you know, divert the course, but just seeing each thought and arise in your mind, placing it on a little log and watching it float down the stream. And I think that's kind of a neat metaphor, because it's like you're not judging, you're not trying to control the flow, you're not holding them back and making a log jam, you're not trying to push them down the stream faster, you're just watching them, you know, just seeing each one attached to a little log in the river, kind of thing. And I think that can be a useful technique of just observing without condemning, without judging, without and that takes practice, of course, because our tendency as egos is to say, oh man, I've had that stupid thought again, I must be a horrible, unworthy person.
Yeah. Yeah. And those are not even your real thoughts.
Exactly.
That's what's so amazing.
Yes.
When, as I began to understand what Jesus was talking about with this ego thought system, you know, I didn't, you know, for some reason I was, you know, obviously like everybody else thinks, this ego is a character that is trying to get me or hurt me or go against me. But really, the ego is just a thought system. It's a framework mm-hmm. that keeps the status quo intact. That's really all it's for, is to keep the status quo intact. And so it will, and it will act and react based on how we act and react with whatever is. So, you know, if we look at what's the status quo and we get mad about it, you know, if we don't like it and then we reject it. And what he's saying here, you can't lay aside the obstacles to real vision without looking at them. For to lay aside means to judge against. So we don't just say, I don't want that thought, and just lay it aside. Actually, he's saying to actually look at those thoughts and let the Holy Spirit be the judge.
Right. That's a crucial difference, isn't it?
It's a huge, huge difference. Mm-hmm. Because you're right. This is what we're being taught, is to put those thoughts out and let go of them and let go of them and let go of them. But he's saying, no, you can't do that. You really have to look at them and let the Holy Spirit be the one who's the judge. And, however that is, because otherwise, you secretly do believe them. See, you can say, I don't believe in ghosts. And how many of us say that? I don't believe in monsters in the dark. I don't believe in ghosts. And yet, you know, if you are sitting in your chair in your room and you feel a presence, touching your shoulder or, running through you, and you think, ooh, you do believe in ghosts. You believe that something is there. And so, you can't just say, I don't believe it. You have to look at it. Mm-hmm. And you have to look at it with the Holy Spirit. And, not just with your own mind and say, well, nope, there's no such thing as a ghost. I know that. So it's not there. Ask the Holy Spirit, what is this? And be open for the answer.
And what is it for?
What is it for? Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. that's a hugely helpful concept, is if the purpose of something is to obfuscate and to cover up and to deny and to basically hide, that's usually a clue that we're treading on ego turf again, because the perfect openness and clarity of the Holy Spirit's curriculum is that if you look at everything without investment in an outcome, without investment in with the purpose of making things obscure and making things different, and what would be, to me a definition of hidden, something that's hidden is something that is not evident to something else, what could be more obscuring than duality? The idea that there's some part of perfect oneness that's hidden off or separate from or basically secretly or not so secretly, set off in a different space or time, and that covers a lot of ground, doesn't it? That's basically the whole premise and the whole strategy of the ego is to divide, to separate, to fragment out, to shatter, and that's what we think we did to God. And so again, your earlier comment of needing to look at the curriculum of what's ever in front of our face, including all of our everyday relationships with the other people and the other things and all, you know, plants, animals, minerals, whatever, you know, that come across our path, and realize that every single specific thing is by default, by ego's default, a curriculum, you know, an item of, in an ego's curriculum of guilt and sin and fear, but turned around and looked at with the Holy Spirit, it becomes a lesson in forgiveness and release and freedom, which ties into our weekend here, doesn't it?
It does, absolutely.
Our real independence.
The real independence, the real freedom is exactly it. To continue, because that this again is from chapter 12, the rest of that paragraph, or the rest of that section in chapter 12, he says, first he just said you can't shine away what you keep hidden because you haven't offered it to him. And he says, we are therefore embarking on an organized, well-structured, and carefully planned program aimed at learning how to offer to the Holy Spirit everything you do not want. This is a different experience to me. I have not been feeling like I've been on a structured and well-organized and carefully planned program. but that's because of the way that I've done the course. I haven't done, I didn't do the course the way that Jesus designed the course.
We're a bit haphazard about it, aren't we? Yeah.
Really haphazard.
And arbitrary, maybe a little random here and there.
A little random, arbitrary, haphazard. And it's amazing that, you know, picked up as much as I have along the way. Because I'm not a good student.
And that's why, and we're even worse teachers. but that's why, you know, Jesus says, you know, be gentle with yourself, you know, and resign as your own teacher. And that we've been badly taught. And this was originally directed at Helen, I believe. Is I think that was an absence from Felicity, maybe. Anyway, that where I think Ken was talking about, you know, how Helen was complaining, you know, about how the course isn't working, and Jesus says, well, it, you know, that's part of the text somewhere. I forget exactly where, but says, well, you know, perhaps if you would actually try doing what I've suggested, and I'm, you know, paraphrasing greatly, you know, you might discover that it works, you know. And that's because we are all pretty, you know. Oh, maybe I'll try this for, you know, it's we're very faddish, you know. It's like, well, I think I'll try A Course in Miracles for a few weeks or a year, you know. It's like, maybe, you know. And then watching, I'll speak from my hand is raised high in the air, you know. It's like every time, and I've done the workbook a number of times. I don't know, 7, 8, 9, maybe now years in a, you know, sequentially kind of thing. And it's astonishing to me how quickly the concerns and the issues of the day arise, and how I can go, you know, sometimes I'll have this you know, discipline for, you know, an hour or two, and I actually might remember the main phrase of the workbook lesson, if not the deeper connotations, you know, maybe two or three times even. But then, you know, toward the middle of the day, and usually by the end of the day, it's like, oh, I guess I've, you know, there've been 7 or 12 hours that I haven't remembered it at all, you know.
Exactly.
And yet it's supposed to be about mind training. And I think it was lesson 95 where Ken's, one of his audio says, he departs from the usual, you know, content to talk about the process and say, you know, if you're beating yourself up over your lapses in discipline, but you're noticing your resistance, that's usually helpful. Because seeing the resistance and seeing how much we don't want to look, how much we don't want to look at the dark, hidden, you know, recesses of the mind can be extremely helpful if we do it, again, with the Holy Spirit hand in hand and see that, you know, our intention, our purpose for during the course as egos is to not succeed and to not, you know, to seek but do not find is like,
good point.
Well, okay. So if I really don't want to find as ego, then that that identity isn't serving me. So I need to somehow shift my identity from an ego to the Holy Spirit, you know, one of Helen's poems and the gifts of God is, you know, a child, a man, and then a spirit. And, you know, we're basically moving through the really infancy of our spirituality. And when we attain adolescence and adulthood, before we, you know, those are the stages we have to go through in order to have the maturity to then be comfortable enough with the peace that we really are and have and can share before we have the revelatory experience that the Course talks about, right? So we need the basics first, and we need to really get them soundly in mind before we go further. And so that's why we're all in this remedial curriculum.
Exactly. And you also have to think that these original people who were doing this had no idea of any, and this was a surprise to them as well.
Oh, yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
I mean,
Helen and Bill and Ken and Judy.
I'm sure it was kind of a huge shock, a lot of this stuff that Jesus
said. Sure. Oh, yeah.
And really looking, and especially, you know, think about this. You know, if you have had, and I think you and I have both been, I was kind of a perpetual student. I kept going to school and getting degree after degree after degree. And, you know, literally, you know, could have had, you know, a couple of doctorates by this time. however, I kept changing my mind about what I wanted. But, you know, think about someone like Helen who had gone through, and Bill and all of them had gone through all the academics. Mm-hmm. They were educated. They had their doctorates. They were teachers. They were all this kind of stuff. And to have this character and this writing, Jesus telling them, you know, you guys have no discipline. You're completely, you know, you've completely, you know, messed up your own thinking. And here I'm giving you an opportunity to rearrange and think and change your mind. And yet, you know, look at how difficult it was for them. And they were, you know, originally getting this straight from the horse's mouth. And, you know, I didn't see any of them, you know, except maybe Bill and, you know, Ken in the end, became transcendent. You know, it doesn't matter. Unless you are able to actually give your thoughts over and allow your mind to be changed, you can be the best educated person in the world, and you can be the most intelligent person in the world, and this is not going to help you. But he's just saying, just completely, you know, become like these people that really have nothing, know nothing, and recognize you know nothing. And so this is what he's saying. I'm going to start the paragraph again. We are therefore embarking on an organized, well-structured, and carefully planned program aimed at learning how to offer to the Holy Spirit everything you do not want. He knows what to do with it. You do not understand how to use what he knows. Whatever is given him that is not of God is gone. Yet you must look at it in yourself in perfect willingness. For otherwise, his knowledge remains useless to you. And so this is, you know, if you just don't, if you can't give it to him and maintain it and keep it. You can't give a grievance to God and keep it. You can't, you know, you have to give it up completely. And if you give it up completely, he will dispose of it and it will be gone. And that grievance will be non-existent in your mind. You won't even have a memory of it. And you'll say, I remember something, but I don't know what it was. And honestly, that is what happens. And so the advantage to giving up these grievances is not that you're going to be able to carry them and continue to think about them for the rest of your life. It's that you don't have them anymore. And a lot of people are not willing, including me, are not willing to give up their grievances. There's a lot of grievances that I want to hold on to because it seems I have a right to be angry. I have a right to be upset. And you did a bad thing to me.
Well, like Ken says, we all have our victim scripts. You know, they form a very tremendously, but on some level or another, we all think that that somebody did it to us, whether it's our parents, you know, by having sex and making a body that we now think that we're stuck in or whatever, or you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, there's always a victim script somewhere. The particulars aren't important, but other than that, they become our, you know, vitally important classroom for undoing our identification with that victim mentality.
Exactly. So this is why you give it up and then you don't keep it. And he says, yet you must look at it yourself in perfect willingness, for otherwise his knowledge remains useless to you. Surely he will not fail to help you, since help is his only purpose. Do you not have a greater reason for fearing the world as you perceive it than for looking at the cause of fear and letting it go forever? And I mean, this is, if you don't want to let the fear, you don't want to let it go. Mm-hmm. If you're not letting it go, if you're still in fear, if you're still in sorrow, if you're still grieving, if you're still angry, if you're still upset in any way or attempting in any way to get back at people, which I find myself doing as well. I don't think I'm different than anyone else. A very vindictive thought system. This ego thought system does not like to be aggrieved. It doesn't like to be picked on, and it will protect and defend itself in the most insidious ways. Mainly by making me not happy when I see you. And that's horrible.
And that's just one example of projection. How we basically it's the horrific nature of the thoughts that this paragraph, you know, this section FAQ talks about is the fact that it's not really a fact. It's basically the ego's fact, which is the belief that somehow we messed up perfect oneness. We took this all encompassing unassailable peace and damaged it or destroyed it or killed it, and whether you want to call it God or perfection or oneness or whatever, in perfect innocence, we think that we trashed it, and because of that, in so many different ways we come up with ways to hide that, but in order to not confront the idea that we believe that actually happened, we project it out and made up a whole universe to hide from it. And that's where the double shield of oblivion comes in, is that we basically, you know, didn't like the thought system, so get me out of here, so how can I be mindless so I don't have to deal with it? Well, I'll make up a whole world. But of course that doesn't work either, but you know, we have the fantasy or a hallucination of believing that it somehow sometimes seems to work, but then it keeps coming back to us that our discomfort with the things in the world, whether it's our body or our relationships or our, you know, with people or things or whatever, it always comes back to that, well, there's ultimately something in the mind that needs to be addressed, and that's where, of course, miracles is squarely aimed at.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the thing is, you know, if you don't think that this is a practical course, and, I, the first few years, I mean, I did see it was practical, but I was very, theoretical about it. I was, mm-hmm. you know, and so it's really easy when you're just theoretical to say, oh, the world is not real. And those are not my own thoughts and things like that. But the reality of them when it starts really hitting you, that Jesus is quite literal with this stuff, and he really is saying that the world is not real. And I don't have a way of handling that in my own mind, and I don't think anybody else does either, because this, you know, the purpose of the mind is to keep the world real. The purpose of our thinking is to keep the world real. So, I'm just doing the opposite by proclaiming it not to be. But to actually be able to see that that's true, that the world is not real, you have to bring that thought to the Holy Spirit.
Right.
and ask the Holy Spirit to show you, and not try to think. And again, you know, you love it, I love it too. This whole thing, quantum physics, and all the things in the world of science that are, you know, showing us that, you know, what we believe is true is really true. That the world is not real, and it's all this and that, and we control it with our thoughts and all this and that. But, you know, again, that's beside the point. And that's our attempt to make some sense out of something that has no reason. It has no sense.
It's bankrupt. 0 cents.
Zero cents. So it's still an ego preservation device. You know, as much as I love the science, it may be pointing to, you know, something that says that what Jesus is telling us in the Course is true, but it's still pointing to a physical world. It's right. Still pointing to laws of physics that are not really laws at all. They're the laws that we made up to make it work. You know, whatever that program, the Matrix is, that's exactly what it is. You know, we're programmed into the Matrix, and
that's what was really revolutionary about quantum physics is obviously the whole semiconductor industry and nuclear technologies and all that kind of stuff that took off from that, you know, point. You know, we can point to the history of technology on this planet, you know, we could say, wow, that was the real revolution. But the real revolution that was underplayed in the media was that the mind was implicated as primary. And that is something that even modern physics just barely skirts around. There's some of the more progressive physicists like John Wheeler, and I think a lot of the earlier ones really got that. And they tried to express it, and some of them became, you know, if they weren't already, and they probably were, mystics, and, you know, Einstein among them, of course, but Planck and Heisenberg and Bohr and all those folks, you know, they had these sort of mystical realizations. It's like, well, if this really is, as the Eastern mysticism had been sharing for millennia, you know, a dream or a fantasy or a giant movie, you know, pick your metaphor, then, wow, what are we doing here, if we're not looking at the mind? Because that's really the whole thing. And that's where I think, Ken Wapnick's brilliance is, you know, among many places is where he points out that the Eastern traditions gave us the idea of Maya or illusion, and that the world is an illusory thing. But if you just stop there, you know, like in the real alternative in the last chapter of the text, if we just stop there, that's just depressing, because that basically says, well, okay, now we're stuck as bodies in the world. But the whole idea is that it's purposive, that the mind chooses one of these two thought systems. And if we can, and that we can choose another thought system that leads us out of identification with the form. And that's where the real freedom lies. That's where our real Independence Day, if you will, comes, you know, closer, is as we recognize that the purposive nature of the ego thoughts is to keep us enslaved. And the purpose of nature of the Holy Spirit's thinking and its curriculum is to release us from that identity and to gently, systematically, but it takes practice, go through all of these steps and not skip over them by looking at everything in our lives that we're upset about or not at peace with and saying, I must have chosen wrongly because I'm not at peace. I could choose peace instead of this. And see the purpose of nature of the ego's curriculum and just say, this is nuts. Why would I keep doing this? And just gently let it, you know, set it aside. And that's when we pick up the hand of our inner kindness teacher and say, hey, you know, I think I like your curriculum. And over time, we develop a maturity with that understanding and we go home.
So, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And the thing I think that a lot of, again, for me especially, is that it's hard work. Okay. It's not easy.
Right.
You know, he says, you know, it takes a little willingness. It does take a little willingness.
Initially.
But he said, you know, it was his final lesson and it took great willingness. Willingness and effort in order to, for him to even hear only one voice.
Right.
It does take, you have to be willing. And the thing that is so helpful is that as you have success You know, as you are willing and you turn things over and you let things go, you begin to have a release from the suffering. You begin to see and not suffer the way that you had been, and that will continue to give you the willingness, and your willingness grows. And you know, he says that if it weren't for the fact that you are so heavily assisted and aided by forces that you don't even see, once you've decided to do this, once you've put your mind to this, all the forces of the universe, heaven and earth, come together to aid you, to help you. And so he also says, and this is another thing that I think a lot of Course in Miracles students do not do or do not know. He says that there are, you know, basically ascended masters. What is it that he talks about?
I think the word angels is used sparingly in the course, but
there's couple of,
again, metaphors for that aspects of ourselves that we've designated to help ourselves get out of the dream, you know?
Exactly. And in the section in the Manual for Teachers where he says, can God be reached directly, section 26, he says this. He says, there are those who have reached God directly, retaining no trace of worldly limits and remembering their own identity perfectly. These might be called the teachers of teachers because although they are no longer visible, okay, so they're no longer here in the world, their image can yet be called upon, and they will appear when and where it is helpful for them to do so. So he's talking about actually physically people appearing in front of you like Artin and Persa.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, this is a lot of, you know, Course in Miracles students say, well, that can happen, you know, that Artin and Persa thing is a big, you know, joke or whatever. He's saying right here, they will.
Well, of course, the irony of that is that Artin and Persa and the Course itself suggest consistently that if we believe that we're in a body, just as they appeared to be in bodies, We're making that whole thing up.
Exactly.
I mean, to me, the sublime irony of that is people who make a big deal out of that is like, well, I'm not in a body. You're not in a body.
Right.
If we think we are, then we're buying into that hallucination. And yet we need those symbols. We need those metaphors because, as today's workbook lesson points out, you know, all we think about is symbols in this world. We need those symbols in order to get back to our minds and to undo the belief in separation.
Exactly. So I'm just going to continue this little paragraph two in the 26th Manual for Teachers, just because this is so important. He says, they can be called upon and they will appear when and where it is helpful for them to do so. To those whom such appearances would be frightening, they give their ideas. No one can call on them in vain, nor is there anyone of whom they are unaware. So these beings, teachers, who are obviously, I mean, it's not like separate beings. I can't imagine. And yet, you know, Jesus, Artin and Persa, Buddha, whoever you want to call on, they're hanging out, you know, somewhere. and that's all in my own mind, waiting to help us. All needs are known to them.
Yeah.
All mistakes are recognized and overlooked by them. Mm-hmm. The time will come when this is understood. And meanwhile, they give all their gifts to the teachers of God who look to them for help, asking all things in their name and in no other. So, you know, these guys are hanging out, you know, waiting for our every, like, the Holy Spirit is hanging out, waiting for our every request and willing and wanting to give us everything that we need. And so, you know, this is what, you know, like I said, I never believed this stuff, and I used to think that it was all imaginary because I never read the Manual for Teachers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like how that last paragraph concludes with asking all things in their name and in no other, because that basically is saying the equivalent statement to elsewhere in the courses where it says God is and nothing else is.
Yes.
Because the nothing else and in no other is basically saying that in order for us to really have, you know, the revelation, that final step, which we keep wanting to skip over all the intermediate steps, we have to consistently choose against, not in any condemning way, not in any judgmental or vindictive or mean-spirited way, but in a very extremely gentle way, we have to judge and choose against our egos and just see very dispassionately that that thought system isn't working for us. And that's the not no. That's the no other. That's the saying to the ego, you know, you're not working for me. I'm dropping you as a teacher. And that is, again, what is we're so afraid of. But like you said, you know, each step is so heavily reinforced, and it would be difficult were not each step so heavily reinforced. And we do have that help. And it takes countless forms. And sometimes they seem to be angelic or ascended masters or whatever metaphor works for us is fine. They can be specific people that just happen to show up at the right time in our life that give us, you know, either words of encouragement or say, hey, check out this article or in this magazine or this book or this website or, you know, whatever. And suddenly we find ourselves back into that mindful state that peace, you know, and it's not because of the specific. It's because we've chosen a different teacher, and that has reflected in a specific that we can be comfortable and not plunge ourselves into fear with. And we can say, oh, well, now I use this specific to get me back to that state of mind. Well, actually, it was the mind's decision to be in that state of mind, and that was just a symbolic emissary that, you know, we felt comfortable with, right? So, and that's where, you know, we have this whole developmental sequence that's a matter of our own comfort zones and comfort levels, and we get a chance to very gently, very gracefully, very peacefully traverse this if we consistently and in an well-organized way just practice listening to our inner kindness teacher and saying no to the ego. And that's it. Should we read the last sentence?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. This is the process Jesus wants to focus on and not slip past, thinking we are already too spiritually advanced to have to engage in such work and that we don't need any help. That's such a great mind, because we're all in the same boat here. I mean, you know, like it says, the teacher of teachers, you know, don't have a physical form. I was thinking earlier today, it crossed my mind, one of Richard Bach's quotes of, you know, here's a mission to see if your life, or if you're, here's a test to see if your mission in this world is finished. I'm paraphrasing this from the Illusions book, you know, Richard Bach's Adventures of a Reluctant Messiah. You know, if you're alive, it isn't. You know, and if you're still here, if you still see, like Ken Wapney says, if you still see a reflection in the bathroom mirror every morning, you know, then maybe we're not as far as long as we think we are, because you know we still think that there's a specific person and a specific body, you know, that has a story and a social security number and a telephone number and a yada yada, all that stuff. And as long as that's in place, we have a forgiveness curriculum still in front of us to work on, right?
Exactly.
And we can afford to gently laugh at that, right? Oh, go ahead.
Exactly. And we can afford to laugh at that. And that also says that, you know, there will be a time, and he says this over and over also, that what we will be seeing is not what we see with our eyes right now.
Right.
That when you achieve what he calls Christ's vision, then what you will see is just, when you look at a person, you will just see a little shadow circling around the light. Mm-hmm. You won't even see the face of Bruce. I don't know what that's going to look like.
Well, it sounds refreshing. I think we get glimpses of it, don't we? Because we occasionally, you know, when we get into a mindful state where we recognize that, you know, every one of us is all of spirit you know, and we can practice this. I love that exercise in Gary Renard's Fearless Love audio. It says, if we can just remember to see all of spirit, not just part of it, but all of spirit in everyone we meet, that gives us these little glimpses. And they're cumulative. They start adding up to a shift in our identity over time. And we start to see that, well, gee, if I'm seeing all of spirit in everyone else, then, you know, by extension and by extrapolation and association or whatever, that must be me too. And so, you know, it's when we look beyond the superficial, what's in it for me, the bodily needs, the financial needs, the Bruce needs, you know, as we imagine them, and practice that, you know, the secret of true prayer is the song of prayer. You know, it's just, my favorite phrase in that is, the secret of true prayer is to forget the things you think you need. And if I can look past what I want to get out of a situation and just see that there's an incredible depth and beauty and richness to each seemingly separate thing. We all get little glimpses, you know, now and then, and they do start to accumulate. And that's where it is a developmental program that this FAQ talks about.
Exactly. Yeah. And you do get more of those little glimpses if you guess what? If you practice. And, you know, that's what I've been finding is that, you know, I've been kind of given a little bit of a direction to instead of, you know, looking for the Christ in me, to actually look at my brother, no matter how irritating they may seem to be, and recognize that they are God's love. You know, I'm rejecting God's love all the time by rejecting my brother in any way at all. And so, you know, once you start seeing that you're doing that, and you actively work to stop, and it has to be active. You can't just say, I don't want to do this anymore. I've done that for years, gone on saying, I don't want to do this anymore, but not looking at why I did want to keep doing it and recognizing that I was doing it on purpose. You know, and again, thinking I was a victim of my own self, mm-hmm. Pretty basically.
What else could we be a victim of, right? And yet that self is made up too. And I think that's the the later phase. You know, first we project it out onto other people and blame everyone else. And then, you know, as it of course points out, then the tendency is to harbor that grievance within. And that's when, you know, usually is a dark night of the soul kind of thing starts happening. It's like, well, gee, I can't escape this self. Well, actually, we can. And that's what the A Course in Miracles basically developmentally, step by step, practice, teaches us and leads us to do is to look at the self we think we made and not just demolish it without having a replacement, but realize that that was a substitute. That crazy thought was a substitute for the real self that we all share. And that's where the shared interest and the kindness and seeing our brother as ourself and as all of spirit comes in. And that develops the identity that we take with us that we've never left, really, that you know, wherever we go, that becomes then the peaceful identity that once we begin to identify more and more and more with that, why would we want to have this dysfunctional, unhappy identity? And you know, that's reinforced at every step in our forgiveness classroom, huh?
Exactly. Absolutely. And it all comes down to what do I want?
Yeah.
What do I want? And again, you know, not going on about my guilt thing, but looking at, you know, the source of all of these things is guilt.
Yes.
And look at those and ask not only, you know, what is the guilt that's involved in this, but why do I want to keep it? And it becomes so easy to see after a while why I want to keep it. I get a lot of attention for it. And I give myself a lot of attention for it, and there's a lot of perks that come to us from suffering.
Yeah.
So
we think there's payoff, but there's, you know, it's, yeah, it's an imaginary payoff or an imaginary problem.
And so you have to give up your idea, first off, that the suffering is necessary and that it's helpful, or that it's it defines you, because in a lot of cases we let our suffering define us.
Yeah.
And again, it's not what we are. You know, I'm not a cancer survivor. I'm not a childhood trauma survivor. I'm not a PTSD survivor. I'm not all these things. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not a whatever it is you define yourself as. Look at that definition and see how much that definition is upheld by suffering and sacrifice.
So would recovering dream repair technician also fit there?
That would also fit. It's not who you really are, sir.
I know.
We shall have a Bureau of Identity here, and you shall come to the Bureau of Identity.
The Forgiveness Bureau of Identity? Is that the new FBI?
Yes. Hey, you know what? I like that. The Forgiveness Bureau of Identity. And when you come to the Bureau, we will help you figure out who you really are. So,
you know, one little comment, because I know we're running quite a bit over, but I think guilt, because you mentioned guilt, and I think it's very important to you know, relentlessly bring that up. And I think a lot of people say, well, I know a specific person in my life that says, well, I don't know what was guilt. And so I would say to anyone who doesn't think that there's a guilt issue going on, just, it's the same thought system as discomfort, dis-ease, anything that's less than perfect peace. I think that, you know, opens it wide up. And if we just basically notice when we're not at peace, when we're feeling the least bit uncomfortable about anything or anyone or whatever, that's the same thought system. I mean, if the word guilt doesn't work for you, just look at gently without dwelling on it. Just notice the things that come up that are uncomfortable. Put them on the mind's altar with the Holy Spirit and hand in hand, and just say, let's look at this together, and then watch it disappear. But that's only when we bring it to that place in our mind with that understanding, with that maturity and willingness to not identify, but to look, and with very infinite gentleness at all the shenanigans that the ego dishes up.
And it's pretty crazy. And so much of what we in our society define as goodness, mm-hmm, is really a reaction to guilt.
Yeah.
So much of what we define as being, you know, kindness,
right,
is really just trying to overcome guilt.
Right.
You know, and if you look at, you know, the charities, you look at environmental groups, you know, Save the Whale, Save the...
There's only one left?
Yeah, pretty much so.
I usually think of it as plural, but I guess there's just one whale in truth, right?
In truth, yeah. But yeah, just look at, you know, what is the purpose? What is the reason, you know, I water my next door neighbor's lawn? You know, why do I water the next door neighbor's lawn? People in the neighborhood might think, well, it's because you don't want the neighbor's lawn to look worse than yours because you know, property values or some other crap. No, because I feel guilty that I have enough money to pay for water. So, and I know that they don't. They have, you know, children and they're, you know, having difficulty with finances. So I water their lawn. It seems to me as a kindness, but really it's because I feel guilty because I have money to pay for water and they don't.
Go ahead.
Yeah, if there was more things I could do for them like that, I would. Well, not because I love them or I love their lawn. It's guilt.
Well, what I was going to say, that's a great example, and that's one of countless examples where we could, by looking at it, the behavior may not change at all, but when you see the motivation there and see the guilt-inspired motivation and then bring it to the mind with the Holy Spirit, you can shift the motivation over time. Because once you've exposed that, it's like, well, gee, I don't have to use that as much. You might still be watering the neighbor's lawn, but then with that understanding, you could say, gee, I can do this because I want to, not because I'm motivated out of some, you know, guilt or need to remedy or fix something on the level of form, but because I just feel like it. You know, I think that frees us up to, you know, but that takes a really tremendous honest assessment and a consistent one, because, you know, the underlying ontological guilt may still be there. So that's why a lot of times in Art and Peirce's curriculum with Gary Renard's books and work, you know, they say, you know, you may be forgiving the same thing over and over again, but know that you're undoing the guilt at different and deeper levels each time. Even though the form may be the same, you know, you might go to the same job and have the same people there that you're irritated with or whatever, or the same traffic on the freeway. And then, you know, maybe different cars, but the same phenomena. But every time that you forgive something that you are upset with, recognize that is undoing, that identification with a thought system that doesn't serve you.
Exactly. And the questioning, because once you recognize that, hey, you know, I was suffering from this for how long, and now I'm not suffering from it. What else am I suffering from that I have no reason to suffer for? And so you begin to see that, you know, all these things that you're doing to yourself, you can let go of, again, with the Holy Spirit. You can't just let go of it, as we just read, unless you actually bring it to him and have him dissolve it, then it's still going to be in the corner of your mind. And maybe that's a part of the reason that you keep forgiving the same thing over and over, because you really do not let go of the fundamental core belief that is keeping that held in place. And there is, I think, a time or point where you reach where you have let go of those fundamental core beliefs, and then all that stuff just falls down. All that stuff just falls away. And, you can see sometimes where you hit places where there's just a huge blockage, and all of a sudden there's like a flood of relief, and all these thoughts that you had just go rushing out, and you're no longer plagued by them. You know, that's the work of forgiveness, and that's the joy that it brings about, and why it's so essential that we do it. And even, you know, I'm looking at, because I'm in that ministerial program, so I'm looking at the Bhagavad Gita and the Tao Te Ching, all these books, they say exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same thing, just different terminology. But I'm actually thinking about writing the Tao of A Course in Miracles, and showing how it is directly related, the entire thing. So, you know, it's all different methodology that brings about the same result, and it really basically is all forgiveness. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, all right. Well, thank you so much, Bruce.
Thank you, Lynn, as always. Yeah, it's always a delight, and everything you say always seems to remind me of what I need to hear. So, I think it's reciprocal. It seems
it is.
So, you know, what a great opportunity to share with each other and whoever else is listening, and remind ourselves what we all are here to learn.
The great value of joining.
Yes.
The great value of joining is Jesus again points out to us over and over and over. That is really when the teaching and learning goes on, and the salvation and forgiveness happens. So we're doing it right. Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls.
Thank you, Lynn Johnson.
And we'll see. Did you just say you're not going to be here next week? Oh no, somebody else just said they weren't going to be here. Okay, okay, you're here. All right, Bruce. We'll talk to you next week, if not sooner. And I'll send
you a great week.
Recording. All right. Happy Independence Day.
Right. To all.
All right. Love you, Bruce. And Lynn says she loves us both. And Carrie says we are rolling today. Very insightful sharing. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Yeah. All righty. Talk to you next week, Bruce. Bye-bye.
Bye.